Oh, I'll start again. Today is Wednesday, June 27th, year 2001. We're in Lansing, Michigan. I am Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Wendell Westcott for the Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial, which will be commemorated 4 years from now in the year 2005. Dr. Westcott served as the university cardinal from 1941 to 1987. Dr. Westcott, you see we have a tape recorder here. Do you give us permission to record this interview?
Yes, very much so.
I'd like to start with a couple of brief questions about your personal educational background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school?
Well, I was born in Michigan, went to school to Michigan State University. It was Michigan State College in those days. The education that is more pertinent to the Carolin, I studied in Mechelen, Belgium at the Carolin School, and graduated, dates are 1957, it's years and years ago. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I got the highest rating diploma of anyone who ever graduated from that school.
Mm-hmm. Why did you come to Michigan State College as a student?
I was originally an organist. My first formal instruction in music was on the organ rather than the piano. And then I took up the piano later. So I was a pianist and organist before I came. It was quite accidental that I came to Michigan State. A violinist friend said there's a new department up at Michigan State, a new faculty. They've brought in a lot of outsiders who are outstanding musicians and have more or less renovated the music department. And so I went up and found out, sure enough, there was a very distinguished musician teaching piano. And I studied piano and theory for 2 years with a theorist, Arthur Farwell, who was a major name in the world of composition. So I was studying privately first with the teachers, who then told me I should really enter college and get a degree. So that is what I did. And after the bachelor's degree, the music department for the first time initiated a program of higher education. And so I was one of the first of those to enter the graduate school and get a degree, master's degree in piano in 1989. That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, 1939. 1939. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about the background to the Carillon? How was it that MSU got a carillon, or what's the tradition of the bells?
Quite a background, a lot of history that led to the MSU carillon. The carillon was just introduced in this country in 1922, so that by the time Michigan State became interested in bells, the carillon itself was a novelty. A few educational institutions had carillons, a handful, meaning not more than half a dozen. And so when the tower was built as a memorial to the fact of the first building teaching scientific agriculture anywhere in the world, they felt that they needed to have some bells. They'd learned that bell towers really are for the purposes of containing bells. They knew nothing about the subject of what to have, so a committee went over to Ames, Iowa State College at the time, who had a small carillon, and the result of that, rather than another small carillon, was to order 10 bells. Perhaps they were short of funds, and 10 bells were better than not having any. They found, though, once they had installed those, and to my knowledge, that might have been about 1927. I don't have the exact dates of that because it was before my time, but shortly after the tower was built, the 10 bells were installed.
And this is Beaumont Tower?
In Beaumont Tower.
Mm-hmm.
They could not play the alma mater they discovered. I guess they didn't think about what they're going to do with those 10 bells when they got them, except ring them if they had a football victory or so.
Mm-hmm.
So they did get the next year three more bells to allow the alma mater. 13 bells was still meager because the history of bell ringing in this country had been bell chimes in churches and town hall towers of perhaps of 8 to 16 bells, and so they joined the ranks of the bell chime installations of having something at least you could play a few recognizable tunes, maybe changing a note here and there if you didn't have that particular accidental. But that was not considered too much, considering that there were a few other colleges with bona fide carillons, so they ordered in 1935, that was a few years later, you see, 10 more bells to make 23, which technically makes it a carillon. You have to have 23 bells for the term carillon to be used, which is actually two octaves of bells minus the two lowest chromatics, C sharp and D sharp. So the MSU carillon then was born in 1935. When it became a set of 23 bells played from a clavier of levers with some pedals as well for the larger bells, so you're seated to play it as you do the piano, where the previous chimes were played from what we call a chime stand, standing up, and with a lot of effort depressing keys at a distance of about 6 inches, which takes a little time, so you can't play very fast and you don't play rapidly on a chime. So the I inherited then a carillon of 23 bells when I was approached to see whether I would be interested in taking up this instrument. The music head at the time had come from a small college in the south. There was a carillon, so he was aware that the best candidates for the carillon were organists, and I happened at the time to have been the church organist at Central Methodist Church in Lansing, and so he called me in and wondered if I would be interested, and I said yes. Just because it was another activity that that might have possibilities. After a year, though, I entered the, along with many others, the Army of the U.S. to fight against Germany. And so that was my experience of for the first year. Then during those war years, they did find students who were able to, at least to find some notes to play simple music, and so that was the interval while I was away. So I began again the fall of 19. These dates are confusing now in my later years.
1947. Okay.
Fall of 47. And played until the summer of 1985.
Okay. Did who made those original bells?
Yes. I don't recall if I mentioned the chimes of the 19th century were all made by American bell founders. The carillon was unknown, of course, and there was no need to go elsewhere when we had perhaps two dozen bell foundries all over the country.
What caused the demise of the American foundries?
If it were not for some of the circumstances of history, we might not have a carillon today. But during World War I, the siren was invented. I have this information from one of the founders who no longer was in business, Manili founder in New York. The siren put out of business, he said, the American bell business, because so many of the situations where the bell was used, now it was cheaper to get a siren which really carried a longer distance and was more practical. Mm-hmm. So the invention of the siren during World War I made the American bell foundry industry extinct. I don't think most people are aware of that little tidbit of history.
Mm-hmm. What company was it that had that made the bells that ended up at MSU?
Yes. So we're now going to Europe for the rest of the American bell history. All mm-hmm. the bells today come from Europe. There's not a single American foundry in existence. Although one did make one Carillon. There was one Carillon. I think most of the bells have been replaced by European bells now, by the Manili company in Troy, New York. Before World War II, two English foundries dominated the bells hung in belfries in this country. John Taylor in Loughborough, England, and Gillett and Johnston in Croydon, England. The bells, our first 23 bells from the 10, then three bells later, 10 more later, all came from the Gillett and Johnston bell foundry in England. When I took over then in 1941, I was playing on Gillett and Johnston bells. Following the war, I thought as a musician who played the piano and organ that 23 bells were not enough to do very much on. I needed a better instrument to play the music that would attract my interest. Otherwise, I think I would have, after a couple of years, I would have given up thinking this is too elementary for someone who is doing piano and organ. Just by coincidence, when I thought, I would like to have a larger carillon, the head of the A. Bell Foundry in the Netherlands, Pellet & Fritsen Bell Foundry, was in this country trying to reestablish their business. They had been taken over by the Nazis during the war and had done nothing for several years and were just broke. And they thought perhaps the American market might be a good thing to enter to reestablish. They did get an order down in a suburb of Cincinnati. I learned about that and contacted the representative, who happened to be the head of the foundry, who came up to MSU. Yes, we'd be glad to help you out and supply some more bells. We then had the second installation in this country of Pettit and Fritzen, who now probably have more carillons in this country than any other single founder. I can't be sure of that, but at least during my time, they had. Actually, I played dedication recitals on 30 of their instruments around the country, so wow. That's one of my...
And you visited the factory there, or the foundry in the Netherlands?
Well, I not only visited the factory, but because I had already... I have to get my date straight. This is in later years, when I started the Spartan Bell Ringers mm-hmm. of handbell ringing. That was 1954, yes, we're still in that time period. I said another thing you could do to enlarge your business would be to get into the handbell business. We only have one foundry in the world, the Whitechapel Bell Foundry in England, where I had gotten my bells, and so that might be a good thing to do. And they took me up on it and engineered some handbells. So while I was over in Belgium working to get my degree in carillon, they engaged me to come over to the Netherlands once a week and organize a group of their foundry workers, none of whom spoke English, and I did not speak Dutch, mm-hmm. although one had enough English to transmit some of my directions. Mm-hmm. I arranged a lot of Dutch folk songs that they learned, and lo and behold, a concert was arranged, attended by, that was broadcast on Dutch national television and radio, and all the press were present, and this group of Dutch foundry men played a very fine program of Dutch folk tunes that was heard in all of the Netherlands. The fact that an American had introduced handbells to a bell country such as the Netherlands was a major of major interest to the Dutch, so I have two or three dozen press notices from the various newspapers that I had to pick out of the wastebasket at the Bell Foundry, who didn't consider that of any particular importance, to add to my archives. So I was very pleased that I had one little part of the bell history of the Netherlands by introducing them to another kind of bell ringing done on handbells. Yeah, I lost my train of thought.
How many, when you said you went to the Netherlands and or you contracted with this foundry, how many more bells did they provide for the MSU Carillon?
Yes, so as I've earlier said, 23 bells were very limited for musical expression. So that as a result of this head of the foundry from our Richtel coming here, we ordered 14 treble bells. A year later, six more. I have to say that the MSU Development Fund was responsible for this addition. Fortunately, a very fine gentleman by the name of William Davidson, Bill Davidson, was running the Development Fund in those days, and he shared my interest in enlarging the carillon to make it into a better instrument. And so the 14 bells led to six more the next year to make 20. And then in 1957, four more bells to make 47. So for the greater part of my career in Mission State, I had 47 bells or a range of four octaves. Part of them, 23 bells. Well, then in addition to four more bells, Gillett and Johnson, 27 bells then, Gillett and Johnson, and 20 bells, Pettit and Fritzen. Now, I might mention that the last history, so far as the bells are concerned, the Eisvalds firm, another Dutch firm, had been experimenting in the 1950s to try to improve the treble bells. In fact, that had been the problem from the beginning in the 15th century. They could only tune up to a certain range, and they didn't have tuning forks or means to control tuning with any precision in the upper registers. In the 17th century, improvements were made, but most of the carillons in Europe were three and a half octaves. The improvements that this Eisvalds factory made were to greatly increase both the timbre and the control of tuning of the treble bells, a lot more brilliance, so that the last installation that we have done that were installed in, I believe it's 1997, were 22. We added two bells to the Fritzen. We scrapped the Fritzen bells, and we have 22 Eisvalds bells that are very superior bells. I can feel that no one has surpassed the Eisvald treble bells, and I'm sure other founders are analyzing the bells to see what they can do to improve their trebles, because the Gilla Johnson troubles were not good. The Taylor, I'll have to be blunt, were worse. So many of the Taylor bills in the existing Carolines, as example Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan, changed their Taylor bills. And I believe they, I'm not sure. They got Dutch bills, but I'm not sure which foundry they went to. So I better not comment on that.
In the 1950s, when they got some from England also, you were mentioning those.
Yes.
Over that circumstance.
When we got as many I felt that we needed in the treble, it would be better to have more bells in the bass, because you might say that the status of the carillon is judged by how big your treble, how big your bass bell is. Mm-hmm. The largest bass bell, unless there has been one since, and it could well be that there has been, is at the Riverside Church, New York, which is 20 tons. I've played that many times, and it takes quite a, well, they have a little electric help on that. You have to turn it on, you make an electric connection to ring that. So at least coming down to the pitch middle C, which I engineered by having four bass bells, it gave us a range, a four octave C to C. So the present range, they didn't change the bass, but they added two more bells. So you have C to C plus C sharp and D, two notes over four octaves. So a far better, you need some bass. It's like the violin only goes to G. Well, we have a piano and orchestra to accompany the violin that could go down lower, but if everything were just from that low G on the violin with nothing more, you feel that here's an element of musical expression that you need to complete the range of to do everything you want to express.
What was the company that you got the bass bells from, or that university contracted with?
We went back to Gillan Johnston, the original maker of the first 23 bells. And then it's a by sideline, because the Gillan Johnston had gone bankrupt. They had the John Taylor, the other English foundry, cast the bells, and the tuner from Gillan Johnston went up to Loughborough and did the tuning. So that and they took the profile from Gillan Johnston, so they are really more Gillan Johnston bells in the bass. But the actual tuning, or casting rather, was done by the one who had been, am I confused? The tuning was done by the original Gillan Johnston man, mm-hmm. but the casting of the bells was done at Loughborough.
Uh-huh. And there were some problems with the finances, you had indicated. What was that? Well, the company went bankrupt, so.
I happened to be, in 1956, over in Mechelen, Belgium, studying the carillon. And the order had been placed, I think, before I left for Europe. And things weren't progressing. We didn't hear from them. We wondered, we have a contract, and where are the bells? So I made a surprise visit over to the Gillan Johnston foundry, and sort of got the runaround. At some point, I learned that they were bankrupt, and the bells were being cast in Loughborough by Taylor. But unfortunately, Taylor wanted $3,000 more before they released the bells from their foundry, and I relayed that to the development fund here, that if we're going to get any bells, we're stuck. We've got to pay $3,000 more. Well, they were able to do that, and the bells then were delivered. Mm-hmm. So that's how things go in the world of business.
By modern standards, what would the cost of those bells be today?
Today, the bells that we had, altogether, the bells I was responsible for, of the four bells at the, or involved with, the four bells in the bass and the 20 bells in the treble. The amount we paid, I'll have to make an educated guess, about $16,000. Those same bells today would be probably $200,000. Wow. That's an educated guess, and mm-hmm. I may be a little off, but in that realm, more than five times or more than what they cost at those times. Mm-hmm. So scrapping the $3,000 or so we paid for the first Dutch bells of Petter Fritzen was a very minor thing compared with what we got in place of them.
In the early years, when did you play the carillon?
Yes. Well, lo and behold, in the early years, it was broadcast on the WKAR radio. Yeah. So I vaguely recall it was on noon. It might have been twice a week, but that's so many years ago. That's what I seem to recall, a couple mm-hmm. times a week for 15 minutes, WKAR. And it was a challenge then for a musician to take 23 bells and make it sound as if maybe there are a lot more bells there. As a matter of fact, I'll have to say in my career, I had to dedicate a set of bells somewhere in Ohio, I forget where now, 11 bells. Well, they had a formal dedication and I was engaged with a fee to play on 11 bells. I arranged enough music that when they heard that concert, they couldn't believe that it was all done on just 11 bells.
11 bells. The you mentioned before that initially the bells, the carillon was not under the direction of the
yes,
music
that's,
department.
That's interesting. Things over the years change. At one time, it was Michigan Agriculture College, Michigan State College, Michigan State University. When the bells were first installed, they sort of had a relationship with Campus Spirit, well, which it still does, Campus Spirit. But the Campus Spirit revolved around athletics, the football team, the basketball. So the jurisdiction of the bells, the playing of the bells, was given to the athletic department. Russell Dalbert, who was the swimming coach, was the player. I suspect that he probably had a background of the trumpet because I noticed when I was visited once, the notes were one tone different from the written note from the note he was playing. The trumpet has to transpose, so I suspect that he was a trumpeter as well as a swimming coach. So that existed until, for some reason, the jurisdiction was given to the secretary of the university, who happened at the time to be John Hanna. I don't think we have that position anymore, but it was given to his jurisdiction, who called the music department, because this was sort of a musical instrument, you're the one now to provide a player. I was called in by the department head, who had knew enough that Kioneers come from the ranks of organists, and I was a church organist. And as I've already said, he invited me to play, and I did. And then, as I say, after the war, I wasn't going to go along much longer on two octaves. And because of the fortunate occurrence of the representative from the Dutch foundry being over here, Will Davison of the development farm was very amenable to increasing the carillon. Then I have to say as an aside, my Spartan bell ringers, he wondered in one of our conversations, I saw him many times, what about handbells, do they still exist? We used to have something called Swiss bell ringers. I had no idea, so I looked into it. Yes, they still exist. There are a lot of ladies in New England from English extraction middle-aged, for the most part, who rang handbells and did English change ringing. Yes, there was, I believe there was a guild of the ladies in New England. When I was in connection with the Carolyn, in some respect I've forgotten, probably playing somewhere in Boston, I met with Mrs. Arthur Shercliffe, who was the main head of the handbells, and learned about the handbells. And as a result of our little confab, I think there were two or three of us, we decided to make it national. So I was one of the earliest ones on the ground floor of establishing the American Guild of English Handbell Ringers. I think that little historical fact has long since been forgotten, but there, as I recall, four of us that talked about having it nationalized, and I was getting handbells at the time myself, and so why not have a national guild? Today, many don't know it. The last word I had, there were 10,000 groups